and welcome to RCGP Together Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities team. I'm Rebecca, and this is the first of our LGBT plus focused conversations for you this Pride Month in 2020, sharing perspectives on Pride, in practice and beyond. I'm delighted to have here four GPs who'll be sharing their perspectives on this all-important area. Welcome, and please introduce yourselves.
Hi, so my name is David Hogg. I'm a GP now in Dunbar, just to the east of Edinburgh, but I spent 9 years in the Isle of Arran as a rural GP, where we did some interesting work to highlight how to make services more accessible for LGBTQ plus patients. I'm delighted to join this Zoom conversation, so thank you very much for inviting me.
Hi, I'm Camilla Kamaruddin. I'm a GP principal in East London. I'm also a member of the LGBT plus steering group committee. And I've been a GP in East London for the past 15 years.
Thanks. Hi. Yes, I'm Duncan Shrewsbury. I'm a GP down in Brighton, where I work part-time in a small family practice and part-time at the medical school, where I run clinical and community practice. Part of my work, both in clinical practice and the university, has focused on trying to help address some of the issues affecting the health inequity that people from the LGBT community face.
Hi, I'm Anthony James. I'm a GP trainee in my ST3 year in North London, and I chair the college's trainee community as well. I'm also part of the college's LGBT steering group, and outside of kind of college GP life, I also do a bit of work for my husband's company, so the worst kind of nepotism, as a health advisor at Pink News, which is a big LGBT media company. And I'm a gay man, obviously, with a husband.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you everyone and welcome. Maybe we could kick off the conversation to talk a little bit about your pathways into this field, anything regarding LGBT plus health and any Pride related activity as well.
Yeah, so well, my own pathway into understanding more about the needs for LGBTQ plus patients, as most of us as GPs, it started with a patient who presented to me, who really got me thinking about how we could improve access to services and understanding what's the journey they were about to go on in their, in this case, their transgender kind of journey. And that got me kind of looking on YouTube for some information and looking around the internet and reaching out to some colleagues as well. And that then led me to discovering a tranche of information that had been presented by a doctor called Tom O'Neill, who's a paediatric research fellow. He's done some fantastic stuff on the internet. And then also a chap called Alex Bertie. And all this really got me intrigued about just how difficult it can be, particularly for young people who identify as LGBTQ+, who sometimes experience quite significant barriers, either perceived or real, in accessing decent quality medical services. So that led us to do a bit of work to see how we could improve things on Arran and then actually improve things across Scotland. At that point, I was chair of the Rural GP Association of Scotland. And we put together some information, including on a conference. There's one statistic that still really stands out for me, and that is that apparently teenage lesbian women are at a higher risk of pregnancy in the teenage years than heterosexual women. And that was one of the statistics that Tom presented to us at our conference, which just really gets you thinking about all the aspects of inequalities of access to healthcare. And a big part, I think, it's fair to say that mental health is a large part of supporting particularly younger patients who identify as LGBTQ+. And all these things come into the consulting room as GPs on a very regular basis, but working out how we can adequately support people who identify as LGBTQ+ is, I think, vital to make sure that we make sure that our services are inclusive and are easy to access as they should be.
Yeah, I am a trans female GP, and it's quite obvious that I'm very passionate about trans health. After I fully transitioned I've written an article about my journey as a transgender patient and a GP, and it was published in the British Journal of General Practice about 3 or 4 years ago. And it was quite positively received by the GP community. And I organized the first ever learning event in Tower Hamlets about trans health. I invited a consultant from the Gender Identity Clinic, James Barrett, to give a talk about trans health. And then I've also written other articles. I've written articles about the barriers that that trans people face in sexual health and also in cancer screening. So still very much that we probably need to do to face all these inequalities that's facing trans people. I'm also now probably having discussions with in a group with other trans people from various trans people and allies in various NHS organizations, discussing about ways about trans status monitoring.
So I forgot to mention in the introductions to ourselves that I identify as being a gay man. During my GP training, I was married to a man. Unfortunately, that didn't quite pan out as planned, as sometimes these things happen. But I was very open about my relationship and sexuality. And I think as can sometimes happen, that can sometimes put you in a position where you're perceived as a representative or an expert to a field to which you have nothing beyond your own lived experience to go on, really. And I did my training in a fairly rural area, and encountered some interesting challenges and questions, and would often find myself being approached for advice or being in a position where I would perhaps necessarily need to be either standing up for myself sometimes or for other people. And I guess that probably prompted me to just get better at it and be more informed. I particularly remember one encounter where I had a patient booked in with me who was in his late 50s, and he came to talk to me about feelings around his perceived gender identity and things about that. I was totally ill-equipped, and I, you know, reflecting back on it now, I think I did a horrendous job of that consultation. And I really hope that they got the help that they deserved and needed eventually. But that experience spurred me on to do better next time. My academic background is actually in medical education and working with doctors with disabilities. So my research didn't really have much to do with the field of LGBT health inequalities. But when I started my job at Brighton and Sussex Medical School, I was given the opportunity to rewrite the first 2 years of the undergraduate program from a clinical practice perspective. And I saw that there was an opportunity there to better equip the doctors of tomorrow with knowledge and skills and conversation that would help them at least be more conversant in and sensitive to, if not actually address, some of the systemic inequalities that face marginalized groups, including the LGBT communities. And doing that sort of got me into doing things with the local CCG and supporting local practices and developing some of their work around supporting patients from the transgender community.
And I guess from my perspective, so I think a similar position to Duncan, when I don't think it ever comes as much of a surprise to people when they find out that I'm gay. I think there's a few different telltale signs, predominantly in the way that I dress. I think that probably gives it a quite clear indication of my sexuality. And so I'm kind of, I think that's always, and that's always been kind of the way. I've been always very open about who I am, but I think coming to appreciate what pride really means and what the importance of identity really is has been definitely a journey for me. And I think the reality is that probably started in earnest when I did meet my husband. Obviously, he runs a big media company focused purely on issues affecting the LGBT community. He led the campaign for same-sex marriage in the UK and has always been, you know, if you can imagine someone who is as proud of their identity, and he, as well as being kind of gay, he's also Jewish. He's also got a disability. There's lots of different facets to his identity, which I'd never really started to think about before, was all of those, that intersectionality element of identity. And so I think seeing him be such an amazing role model in the field made me think a lot more around what I could be doing. And I think throughout medical school and the early years of my training, what I was definitely well aware of was that there was very few very visible role models, at least in the kind of university that I was at, and then in my foundation training as well. And I think that does have a big impact on kind of your appreciation of who you are as a person, and also the care that you can deliver to patients. I think bringing your whole self to work is a really important part of being able to provide effective care. And I think that's something that still a lot of people don't necessarily feel confident or able to do. I know that, you know, Camilla and has mentioned that the RCGP was at Pride last year. And I think when I was there, I met a few people who had said, you know, at work, I just, I'm not out to people in the practice because, or I'm just not very kind of comfortable with my sexuality, being open about it there. People might have made comments, either kind of microaggression style things or much more overt homophobia, which made them feel that it wasn't a working environment they could be confident in who they are. And I think the fact that that still exists is a massive issue. And I think that one of the main ways of tackling those kind of issues is around visibility. And I think that's something that we still don't get right in medicine. I think that understandably, a lot of focus is always on the patient and their perspective, but equally there are two human beings in every consultation, and who the doctor is as well is a really important part of that. And I now think that probably being LGBT makes me a better doctor. And I think everybody, whether they're LGBT or from another minority community, or you know, just even a straight white man, has also been through lots of different adversity during their life. And all of those different challenges really influence the care that you deliver and make you a better, more well-rounded person and doctor. So I think that was kind of where my interest in trying to be a bit more visible, a bit more of a champion for being out and open in the workplace began. And then seeing, again, through Pink News, the work that other industries were doing, specifically around those kind of issues, where it felt like people were a lot further ahead than we are in healthcare. And I think now things have started to feel like they're catching up slightly, but I think there's still a lot of work to do. And I think that as doctors, and particularly as GPs, we're in a really prime position for not just helping our colleagues, but also helping patients understand kind of some of these inequalities that still exist in society, and being, and kind of challenging some misconceptions that patients have, I think is an important part of our job. If we are kind of met with prejudice from a patient, even if that's not directed at ourselves, I think it's something that we should do more about, calling out whether that's racism or homophobia or any kind of prejudice. And I think, again, that's something that we haven't necessarily always been empowered to be able to do effectively.
Yeah, I mean, for me, an understanding how we can serve our LGBT patients most effectively, there's some first really important steps that we've learned can be really effective in helping to break down those barriers. I think we're talking a lot about identity, and the whole LGBTQ plus or QI plus or however many letters we want to add on, a lot of this is about what identity people want to subscribe to. And one of the really effective practice points that we were able to share in the fact sheets that we developed, which are still available on ruralgp.scot, is getting an idea of the what language is used, what language people use to express their identity, particularly in the transgender community. Having an understanding from the outset of what does cisgender mean? What does gender dysphoria mean? What do all the letters in LGBTQI plus mean? And what could they mean to different people? And most importantly, that a lot of the time it's okay to ask patients. I think sometimes if we're not sure about exactly what a patient might subscribe to or what identity they want to have, then there's sometimes a hesitation in asking, because it might be seen as prying or asking a question that someone doesn't want to be asked. And actually, when identity is so important, particularly to young trans people, but also to particularly the younger community, or the community of younger people, it's fine to say, so what would you like me to call you? What identity do you subscribe to? Do you want me to call you Z? Do you want me to call you him? Do you want me to call you her? You know, there's ways of expressing it, as with any kind of consultation kind of style, to make people feel as comfortable as possible. But getting the kind of the identity aspects right from the outset, and even that can include a poster in the waiting room to say, we understand, we want to understand how best to support you. Tell us from the outset. Sometimes some visibility from colleagues, from reception staff, or from as simple as posters in the waiting room or things on our practice website. I think these things can all go an extra mile to breaking down some of these inequalities that Anthony was talking about in terms of access to decent healthcare. Because I think often that's the first hurdle. Either people are too afraid to ask, or patients are not sure what kind of response they'll get in kind of telling people how they want to be identified in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with that. I think, you know, a good starting place when it comes to thinking about how you can, approach any kind of minority community is kind of getting rid of presumptions that you might make around people. So just being open, asking people kind of what their life is all about. I think that's really, I think that is a really positive thing. And I think that also, as David says, affirmative symbols within a practice is always really helpful. So we've obviously seen things like the NHS Rainbow Badge, lanyards, things like posters as well, I do all think make a really positive impact. And these aren't things, again, which are just reserved to the LGBT plus community, but affirmative imagery for all minority groups is something important to have in your practice environment, I think.
Building on a couple of points, what partly that Anthony started in his introduction about his journey, particularly talking about your sense of identity having sort of developed and evolved. And I guess really identity isn't as static as we perhaps like to think it is. And that's something that resonated quite a lot with me as you were saying it, because we've met at recent meetings and things like that where I've worn high heels and a bit of makeup and Lord knows whatever else at times. But that's definitely not how I used to sort of dress or feel particularly comfortable with. And that was partly because of not having that insight into myself, and also partly through fear a little bit, which I feel a little frustrated about, that I hadn't quite matured through quicker, because I had been in situations where I was helping medical students years and years and years ago through a mentoring scheme at a local university. And there were medical students who specifically approached the university's LGBT mentoring service who were being told by their parents, well, you can't be gay and be a doctor, or you'll die of AIDS and alone, and you definitely can't, you won't be allowed to see patients if you've got HIV, and if you're gay, you're going to get HIV, simple as. And the number of people who were being told, reinforced those sorts of things, and being told that certain specialties were definitely not for them because you can't be gay in a paediatrician or you can't be gay in a GP. It was heartbreaking. But of course, also fundamentally and totally and utterly wrong, complete nonsense. It was only through going through certain life changes myself and a bit of growth and self-discovery that was a part of my identity. But interestingly, through work with medical students now in my more, I guess, senior role, the students or some students did a project where they were looking at some of the inequalities that affected them and their peers. And they talked very much about having visible role models. And one of the interesting ideas that they talked about was that in areas, and I guess Brighton's a little bit perhaps not quite representative of other parts of the UK, in that there's rainbow stuff plastered everywhere. And most people are aware that there is a significant representation of people from the LGBT community in Brighton. But because of that sort of ubiquitousness of those tokens, it was then impossible for people to discern who was a role model from a within community perspective compared to an ally. And it was interesting that sort of empowered me a little bit to think, gosh, I think it is going to be okay if I am more me in the work environment. And it did take me a little while to sort of build up the confidence and tell myself that it was going to be okay to wear a pair of high heels at work, mostly because I thought I don't want to necessarily make a point at the expense of affecting patient care. I think I probably worried about it a little bit more than necessary because patients have been enormously supportive, receptive, fine. It's only ever really been colleagues that have been funny about it. And actually nowadays, the more people that are funny about it, the more I think that it's doing an important job. So I'm less worried about that. But that touches on role modelling as a valuable thing that I think we can do within our communities, both within in terms of thinking about the LGBT community, but also within the medical profession.
Yeah, I remember it about 3 to 4 years ago when I first wanted to organise a trans awareness event in my borough about gender identity, and there seems to be some barriers. Because I think some of the doctors don't understand what's, you know, the difference between sexuality and gender, and they thought that it was just in one group. So I insisted that, you know, that the learning event, the trans awareness, should be only about gender identity, and once after my the learning event, a lot of GPs seems to understand that there is a difference between gender and sexuality. And so it's okay for GPs in my barrington hamlets, but I think there is still some confusion about, I mean, a lot of, I think still some GPs do not understand that there is a big difference between sexuality and gender. So I think there's still a lot of work have to be done, you know, about educating GPs that there is a difference between sexuality and gender. And we might have recently, there's a lot of talk about inclusivity, diversity, intersectionality, and I mean, no excuses about it. It is what it is, and it exists. Although it seems to have become a buzzword, but yes, it is what it is. It exists, it is real, and it is affecting us in the LGBT community. So I think we must do more. GPs must do more. We must go deeper, and we must continue this conversation. What it really means to us and how it affects us in the LGBT community. There's still a lot of prejudice and discrimination. And also we got to ask about our allies, what they can do more to help and embrace the LGBT community. So recently during the COVID crisis, you know, I've heard cases where GPs were not giving trans men their hormone injections, those injections, because they say that it is not essential. But if you don't prescribe in the hormone injections, you know, their dysphoria might increase and anxiety would arise. And this also can have an effect on their mental health. Yes, you know, we can try and provide other forms of testosterone, but a lot of GPs do not know how to convert, you know, injections into other forms of testosterone. And so you can't just be dismissed as just like not essential and just leave it at that, and then without giving any alternatives or any guidance or any advice to this trans man about what to do next. And their mental health suffers, and I don't think that's right. And it's also about, you know, like, you know, for trans men who wants to have cervical screening, it's very difficult for them. I mean, you don't expect them to come to the reception and ask, like, I want a cervical screening. You know, when the appearance is very much a manly appearance, I mean, they won't do that. You know, I mean, you can't expect them to do that, you know. And so we have to think about other ways how to invite trans men to actually to come for cervical screening. There are other ways. All we just need to do is just, like, you know, think a bit outside the box. There's a lot more that we can do. And, you know, we must, encourage our colleagues and other healthcare professionals to do more. It is almost a duty.
Yeah, Camilla, these are all interesting points that you're raising there without a doubt, and challenging to think about as depending on the level of experience that we have in any clinical field, it's kind of like if you're asked, if you're happy with cardiology and you want to kind of go into the depths of trying different medication, there's a degree of similarity in the needs of transgender people. And sometimes I share the concerns that I think, Duncan, you were alluding to earlier about the in fact, sorry, it was Camilla. You were saying that, you know, sexuality and gender are two actually quite different things. And I sometimes wonder if there's a danger of lumping everything into LGBTQI+, that we're actually diluting some of the key messages that we could employ in our daily practice to support patients who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, because they are quite different kind of things. But that's a big question and one that's kind of been asked kind of several times. I think ultimately it all comes down again to the identity bit. When someone comes in through that door and they tell you they're wanting to go through the transgender process, or indeed they're already transgender and they've got some specific health issues that need to be discussed. As an aside, one interesting side effect of us doing more work on Aaron to engage with our LGBTQ+ community and indeed with our youth club that was set up specifically for LGBTQ+ young people, is that by demonstrating a keenness to work out how we can best support people, whatever identity they have, whether in terms of identity of gender, identity of sexuality, or indeed other kind of identities that we can subscribe to as well, we ended up engaging with people generally better if they saw that we were open-minded to work out how we could support people generally in their identity. We actually engage generally with young people as a whole more effectively, and not just with the LGBTQ+. And I can see Duncan, you're nodding there, and I think we've all got kind of experiences where there's a kind of a spin-off by just understanding or showing a keenness to understand what people see in their own identity, that's a great launchpad for generally reducing the inequalities of access to health services by different minority or majority groups.
I think probably the first thing to highlight, and not on commission from the college for this at all, but is the LGBT learning hub or resource hub, by far in advance of that was the work done by RCGP Northern Ireland, where they undertook, gosh, I think it was back in 2014, I'm not quite sure, but it was a very long time ago, some specific work looking at how the LGBT and transgender also specifically were affected by the sort of barriers and inequalities in the primary care setting. And then the Government Equalities Office partnering with RCGP to develop a new suite of learning resources, some of which Anthony wrote, and the LGBT steering group that Camilla and I and Anthony support were involved in peer reviewing. And I think that also highlights a wider change of direction, a change in conversation across society, that we're seeing perhaps more higher profile conversations led by third sector organizations like the LGBT Foundation and stuff like that, that are all trying to address the issues around awareness and knowledge, which I think is a very positive approach. And generally speaking, I suspect the majority of people who work in healthcare wake up each day thinking, I want to do the best job I can today because I love people, I love helping people, and that's why I got in this game in the first place, rather than thinking, how can I underserve a particular group? And I think often the inequalities that some people face are due to service issues and resource capacity, but also through just lack of awareness and knowledge. And so I think that approach, trying to address that from a positive, let me hold your hand and take you on that journey kind of approach, is I've certainly felt that that's a very positive thing that I hope will continue to support the profession to better address those sorts of needs.
Yeah, I think, I guess on the point that Duncan touched on, I think the third sector always plays a huge part in providing services for any minority community. But I do think particularly the work of organisations like the LGBT Foundation has had quite a profound impact, especially in the last few years since Pride and Practice started in 2016, I think, in Manchester. And so Pride in Practice, they go into GP practices and it's kind of an accreditation and quality assurance framework. Different practices get different awards, so bronze, silver or gold, depending on how inclusive they have demonstrated themselves to be. And there's kind of a whole program of support that goes alongside that. And the LGBT Foundation have now just launched their own training academy as well. So lots of different resources, loads of different training modules that they've made available to healthcare professionals now, again, focusing on a huge range of different issues that are faced by the LGBT community. And I think as well as the RCGP's Learning Hub, which definitely, and I'm not just saying this because I did write a couple of the modules, but is definitely an amazing resource to have out there. But alongside that, having these resources from the LGBT Foundation is really important as well. And I'd encourage everybody listening to go and check out one or both of those. Because I think, you know, the reality is that, as we kind of touched on a few times during this, I don't think that the majority of healthcare professionals are innately prejudiced. That definitely does exist, but I don't think that's the biggest issue. I think the biggest issue is often one of not wanting to say the wrong thing, a bit of fear and apprehension around getting it right for different communities. And so these modules really just help to kind of explore some of the key issues and main challenges that the community faces at the minute, and helping kind of give indications of the best way to be able to support people, not just in accessing general healthcare, but also on some key specific issues. Camilla's already touched on issues around cervical screening and cancer screening generally for the trans community. There are some other specific issues like that, which definitely are more prevalent in the LGBT community. And so I think just having that awareness, not going into a consultation, having prejudged someone based on these issues, but just having an awareness of things that you might want to check in with them about, things that you should just have on your radar, I think is important, and just helps you to have more fulfilling, successful conversations with members of the LGBT community. I think that it also is important, obviously, with everything that's going on with COVID at the minute. A lot of services will be being affected by COVID, and a lot of those kind of safe spaces or different services that members of the LGBT community would be used to accessing are either not necessarily running at all at the minute or not running in the same way. And I guess given the huge financial impact that COVID's going to have on the economy, there's potentially lots of services that might not start running again in the future as well. And I think for all LGBT people, that's going to be a huge challenge. And I think something that we as general practitioners will need to help support people through, as they don't necessarily have those same safe spaces and support networks available to them at the minute. I think it was just for people that are kind of coming out or starting their journey transitioning, you know, they might be now in a state of semi-lockdown still, at least at home with families who might not know that about their true identity. They might not necessarily be supportive of them. And I think if they haven't got access to those other services and those other safe spaces, that's a really big challenge, and one that we're probably going to start to see the impacts of in the coming weeks. I know the LGBT Foundation has already released some early research looking at some of those initial impacts. And they've kind of highlighted that all of the pre-existing issues we know exist in the LGBT community, whether it's higher rates of mental health issues, substance misuse, you know, lots of different issues have all been exacerbated by coronavirus. And so I think that's something that, again, people just need to be aware of, that their LGBT plus patients, colleagues or friends might be suffering and going through some really challenging times at the minute.
And also echo about, you know, during this COVID crisis, you know, it has been quite difficult for some of us in the LGBT community during this lockdown. We have to isolate like everyone else, but for some of us, isolation within a community or household that is not accepting to an LGBT person is who could not live openly as an LGBT person, This has been very, very, very difficult. And so it means that in a lockdown, they don't have a safe space. They don't have, they could not reach out for help and or support, and they couldn't attend community centers or, you know, safe gathering spaces where they can support each other. Yes, they can, you know, reach out with the virtual, you know, Zoom or telephone, but it's just not the same. And, you know, and so they cannot be out and be themselves, and they also don't have any, you know, a shoulder to cry on, or, you know, someone to hug, give each other a hug when, you know, things are really bad. So, and it, the streets are also very quiet and deserted, and for some of us, you know, the anxiety rises because, you know, the risk of being, you know, assault or abuse is, you know, is quite high. And like for me, you know, like I drive to work, when I come back, you know, and I park my car, and I literally the first time ever that I had to run from the parking space to my flat because it's just so quiet. I'm just so, you know, my anxiety rises, you know, thinking that somebody's lurking behind, you know, behind a building and trying to, like, you know, assault me. So the anxiety is real, and we feel it, and it's very palpable, and it's can be quite difficult for many of us.
Yeah, I think just on that, I think specifically, you know, when we talk about the trans community, the reality is that for me, as a, you know, a white gay man, a lot of the freedoms that I now enjoy are not shared by other members of the LGBT plus community. And I think, you know, we can say that most definitely about the trans community, who still every day in the media, in the national media, across social media, are villainized and victimized in a really unacceptable way. And that just, that, you know, is just completely outrageous to still be happening in 2020. And I think that, again, coming back to our role as healthcare professionals, is around kind of being not just supportive to members of the trans community, but again, role modeling as a profession and a group of professionals who support the community as well. You know, as Camilla says, all that trans people want is to be able to live their lives, have access to treatment, have access to services in the same way that everybody else does. But the reality is that for trans people, they do suffer much higher rates of mental illness. They are much more likely to be the victim of you know, either a physical or a sexual assault. You know, life for trans people is not easy at all in the UK, and it's much worse in other places around the world as well. And I think that's something that does always need to be recognised, called out. And I think that's something that, as healthcare professionals, we should be really part of, is kind of helping in that fight for better equality for the trans community.
The RCGP LGBT plus steering group has achieved amazing things in the past year. What do you all see for its future and the future of these issues within the RCGP?
So I think it's important to just outline that the steering group was something that was enabled through that partnership with the College and the Government Equalities Office in terms of supporting the refinement and development of those resources that are accessible and intended for everybody beyond general practice as well, other healthcare professionals too, including from other healthcare disciplines. But as part of that, that facilitated us getting in the same room together and being able to talk, and through that sharing concerns and ideas and expectations. it was through that meeting that we then, or those meetings, that we then started to build momentum for ideas like Pride presence, and it was interesting because around the time there were concerns from the wider LGBT community that might represent sort of pink washing or trying to cover up rather than address inequalities. And certainly, as the instigator for the London affair, I think it's important to say that it really did come from an honestly good place, in terms of there are, you know, from my experience with medical students or trainees or other doctors who feel that they are not able, you know, they either have to pass somehow by pretending to be straight in the workplace, or they are fearful that at some point their sustained engagement and involvement in the profession will be compromised by their identity or sexuality. But also equally that our patients in order to see that some of us can be role models and all of us can be approachable, or at least I would hope that we could be, around these sorts of issues. We needed to have a voice in that field and to say, look, we're here for each other and we're here for you too. And that was a beautiful moment at the London Pride. We had GPs, we had GP trainees, we had parents of GP trainees, we had patients all congregate from across the whole UK in London. And the energy was just wonderful. You know, people who, like Camilla said, who had previously expressed concerns about not being able to be who they are at work, feeling that, oh gosh, no, it is okay. And also, not only is it okay, but there's an important role to this. It's important to my patients that I can be me at work. It's important to the wider community. It's important to society to help continue to nudge things in the right direction. And so, although it's easy to conflate Pride activities with just a simple parade, and I wouldn't wish to diminish it by doing that at all, I do hope that the message that goes along with Pride, around being able to take pride in your inclusive care, being able to take pride in your own identity, being able to take pride in your colleagues and your allies, I hope that the work that we can support as a college will continue with that. And through that, I hope that the steering group can continue to exist in a way that can hopefully represent some of the concerns and issues that our patient community will face, as well as those faced potentially that might disproportionately affect our LGBT colleagues as well within the sort of the wider membership.
I think the fact that the college was the first medical royal college to take part in a Pride March is really important. And medicine is in some ways quite an antiquated system, and it does take time for it to catch up. So I think being ahead of that curve and seeing the college doing some really progressive things is a massively important thing, which I hope can continue. I think, as with any membership organization, I think part of the role of college is all about amplifying the voices of members. And we know that there are a significant number of LGBT GPs and other people working in primary care. And so to be able to amplify their voices, their stories, give them that platform to be role models, to represent some of the views and issues that they face day to day, not just for themselves, but also for their patients, I think is really important. What I would like to see happen is the college also kind of has set up other groups recently, like the BAME group. I would like to see a much more kind of cohesive equality and diversity arm of the college get up and running. And I think, you know, particularly with everything that's happening, particularly in the US at the minute with the Black Lives Matter movement following the death of George Floyd, I think that identity and intersectionality particularly are at the forefront of many of our minds. And I think that that's a really important place for the college to be, is actually being acknowledging that it hasn't always got things right, being open and honest and being vulnerable in some ways as an organization, that it's not, hasn't necessarily always been perfect, but is learning and is moving forward. And I think taking quite clear stances on its support of equality, diversity and human rights, I guess, is a really important place for the college to be, not just for its members, but for our patients as well.
I would like to see opportunities open up more for LGBTQ plus allies as well, so that we make it possible to embed LGBTQ plus issues or concerns and representation right throughout all the many strands that run through our general practice. I'm sure that we've got different views about how much LGBTQ plus health matters are present in the GP curriculum, but let's look at PPGs and how we ensure that there's an LGBTQ plus voice within, and that's helped to be able to foster within patient participation groups. Let's make it possible for everyone to understand how we can support LGBTQ plus patients as to the best of our ability. I would like to see that happen. And I think that there's a real potential here to see that happen. There's a lot of really positive work being done that just has to be amplified up. So we've got a more consistent message to all LGBTQ plus patients right across the UK to feel safe and to feel respected and to feel included in the kind of both health policy, but also in the healthcare delivery in their communities.
So talking a little bit about Pride, which we've alluded to, COVID has obviously changed the landscape of Pride this year. But what's out there? What can people get involved in, whether they're GPs, patients, etc.?
It's a weird year for Pride, a weird year for everybody. But I think it has been heartening to see that, you know, things can still be organised to celebrate Pride and to, you know, mark it as that important point of reflection in the annual LGBT calendar that it is. I can speak, I guess, from a Pink News perspective that we've just finished 4 days of programming for our kind of digital Pride events, which is called Pride for All. And we've got a digital virtual Pride March, which is going on throughout the rest of the month on the website, which the college will be part of as well, which is nice and exciting. So I think as with everything, COVID has obviously stopped a lot of things happening, but it's been amazing to see how new traditions can be formed in the absence of being able to meet up face to face. So there's lots of different organisations that are running Pride events throughout the month. And I think that's really important to be able to provide that opportunity for connection amongst the community, to be able to start to think about how we can provide digital safe spaces for members of the community to come together. And I think that hopefully even, you know, nothing's ever going to replace the atmosphere and the party that goes alongside the really important message that face-to-face Pride events are all about. But I think some of the things that we learned this year about how to do things in a more remote way, how we can engage with a wider community and a greater diverse pool of voices from the LGBT community online, I think is hopefully going to be positive and something that we can take forward.
Hoping to be able to support the NHS Digital Pride. I'm not quite sure where they are with their plans or activities, but I'd love to be a part of that, just to further share some of the messages and the principles that underpinned our activity last year. Beyond that, though, I don't have any particular sort of awareness of events or things to get involved with nationally or locally, but certainly the principle of Pride Month has sort of reinvigorated the sense of what I bring to work, what I bring to, I guess, my own life, although a lot of my life is just within the four walls of my home at the moment during lockdown. But when I get to escape and go to work, I take that message and that authenticity and that compassion and kindness and try to role model it with an increased vigour, whether that's treating myself to a new pair of heels and using that as an excuse or not. But it's also a good opportunity to support some of the other messages around Pride. And Anthony talked about sort of digital safe spaces and things like that. I'm very conscious that a lot of the community are incredibly isolated and perhaps disproportionately so compared to people who might have conventional families and conventional sort of family networks and support networks. And so I think organisations and as Anthony mentioned earlier on, largely third sector organisations who do provide some of those vital support structures, such as the LGBTQ switchboard and things like that, We know that the third sector has been terribly hit economically, but also in terms of their ability to support people to continue working for them throughout this time. So using this as an opportunity to remind ourselves that those organisations are there, do a fab job and need our support too, is quite good. So
I echo what David said earlier about participation from allies. And it is very, very important that allies participate in this fight for equality, diversity and intersectionality, and support the LGBT plus issues. We are in this together. You know, we cannot, it's affecting all of us, not just affecting LGBT people, but affecting all of us. Especially during, it's much more crucial at this time with Black Lives Matter, because trans lives matter too. And yeah, I mean, trans lives, trans people, you know, are subjected to a lot of risk of assault, of abuse, and also, you know, death. So it is very important that we continue this conversation, even if that this COVID crisis is a bit limited, but we can continue this conversation by, you know, social media, by digital, you know, writing articles. There's a lot of ways that we can actually still raise this awareness about LGBT plus issues.
Yeah, I think on the just, I guess, on the allies point, I think also the fact that it's Pride Month has raised a few eyebrows in different bits of the NHS, where since obviously the rainbow symbol has been slightly appropriated by the NHS over the last few months, which, you know, nobody owns the rainbow, but the Pride flag, I think, is quite a recognisable symbol. And I think we've seen a few different NHS organisations using key imagery like the NHS rainbow badge and other kind of similar imagery from that campaign to represent a more general sense of pride for working for the NHS. And I think in some ways that feels quite like, for want of a better term, like LGBT erasure, like those symbols were created for a clear purpose, and for them to be repurposed so easily without seemingly much thought from people in those organisations, I think hasn't been particularly well received by members of the LGBT community, particularly when that messaging is coming out during Pride Month, when you would hope that a lot of the meaning behind what those symbols were meant to represent would be being echoed across different NHS organisations. So yes, we've seen a lot of huge, amazing support for the NHS in general over the last few months. But I think it's important to be clear and to recognise the importance of some symbols to certain communities, and not to, I guess it just shows how easy it is to sometimes make a mistake if you're not speaking to members of the community. The imagery you use, the way that you communicate things, can sometimes get lost. And so I think it's always important to have allies. Allies are really one of the main ways that we create change for any minority group. But if you're an ally, the best way to kind of to move things forward is to speak to members of that community and to work with them to make those changes.
So I guess just to wrap up the conversation, some really great points made. Pride is obviously inherently personal. What does Pride mean to you, and how will you be celebrating this month?
Difficult one to answer succinctly, but I think for me, Pride is taking pride in making progress along that personal journey. You know, I look back to how I felt in my own skin 10 years ago. I look back to where I was as an 8-year-old child. I look at role models around me and I think, am I a closer approximation to what I needed as an 8-year-old in terms of guidance and support? Hopefully. I think Pride is, for me, an opportunity to reflect on that journey, as incomplete as it is, at least I hope anyway.
I think for me, Pride is always around three things. So one is it's a time of reflection over what's happened over the previous year. And I think we can all say there's been some really positive things that have happened across the last year. It's also a time of celebration for some of those positive things that we've seen happen. And then I guess a time of planning for what more can we do over the next year to help hopefully move things forward even further. I think something that I've been thinking about as we've gone into Pride Month this year is actually, you know, I've been the last few months, especially, or the first 6 months of this year, have been incredibly busy for various reasons, whether that's like chairing the AIT community or just my training's been busy, like sitting exams, etc. And actually, I think that some of those roles have taken away from me thinking about what I can add as a member of the LGBT community. And so for me, it's an important reflection to think about how I can continue that journey as a visible, vocal, active champion. And so I guess for this Pride Month, particularly as we've already referenced, everything that's been happening with Black Lives Matter and thinking about that kind of intersectionality piece, Pride Month for me is definitely all going to be about learning how I can be a better ally to particularly like the Black community, Black LGBT community at the minute, how I can help to kind of amplify some of those voices and work with them to help improve things.
Right, for me this year is very much different from last year. I mean, last year we marched in the streets of London and also in Brighton under the RCGP banner. And it means quite a lot for me that, you know, the RCGP has, you know, has, it's a sign that RCGP has embraced the LGBT, the issues that's, you know, facing us, and then, you know, has also, and means say that RCGP has pledged that they're going to help to help us more. So it's quite a, you know, it's a special event for me, and I was quite emotional during Pride last year. And also it's a reflection about, you know, what actually, how wonderful it is, and how, you know, to be myself and to be, you know, out and open, to be visible, and, you know, and to thrive. So it was a quite emotional experience. But this is a bit different. In the there's a lot of hate against trans people, and the hate is, as you know, is more apparent, and is and, you know, every week we hear, you know, I read in the papers, you know, there's a lot of negative news about trans people on Twitter as well. And so it just, to me, Pride this year reminds me that there's still a lot that I have to fight for tolerance, for acceptance for trans people. And Pride this year, you know, reminds me that the fight, you know, for acceptance and tolerance continue.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for sharing that. Huge thank you for joining us on this conversation. It's been incredibly interesting, and I hope our listeners will get as much from it as hopefully we all have. So check out the episode description below to find out a bit more about those involved in the conversation this week, as well as plenty of links to the resources we've all discussed. So maybe tell us a bit more about how you're celebrating Pride this year. Tweet us at Team GP and let us know. Thanks all for now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.